Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 73 of Season 10 of Move Around Minute, the Daily Podcast, where we hijack our way through the 1974 action thriller, The Taking of Apollo 123, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today, after hopefully not having too much of a hangover from his celebratory birthday yesterday, is Alan Sanders of The Alan Sanders Show. Welcome back, Alan.
Thank you very much. Good to be back. And very much enjoyed the birthday celebration. So glad to be here.
I'm glad you did. And I'm glad that you're still not too foggy, that you're gonna be able to talk about what's going on in this minute with me. So minute 73 begins with Garber continuing to read off the demands that Blue has given him, and ends with Garber commenting on Rico's mental health.
If you think about it, and I will get to it toward the end, but I mean, when you say that, it's maybe one of the more quotable lines of the movie.
There's a lot of quotable lines, and most of them are either from Rico or Garber. Those are the two people who I would say are the most quotable here. I wouldn't even say that Blue is that quotable, the stuff that he says, even though I think we've talked about the last few days how he sounds like Gruber a little bit and stuff like that, but they're not quotable lines. But right, the lines that both Garber and Rico throw out, I mean, again, we're gonna have a thing in 2 weeks from now where Rico goes, "Even great men need to pee." I mean, that's just a great line. Mm-hmm. You don't hear lines like that too much in movies where it's told in a deadpan style, but still very funny.
And I like it, even though the movie is not, again, we said this before, it's an older movie, so the filmmaking techniques are not the same as we're used to with maybe the higher action, higher intensity filmmaking of today. But the realism of the dialogue and that sardonic, almost that dry wit of just lifelong people in law enforcement trying to find something humorous to say in the midst of a crisis, it felt real. It mm-hmm. doesn't feel forced.
Right. And I think it also goes along with the fact that these two characters are meant to be pretty close. You know, these aren't just two random cops talking. These are together probably for years. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't know for how long, obviously, but, they have some sort of connection by the way that they talk to one another. And that they understand each other. I mean, come on. Rico the entire time calls him Z. He doesn't even call him Zach or anything like that. He just refers to him as Z. So that in itself tells us, what they're expecting their relationship to be. Mm-hmm. You know, that type of thing. Or what we're supposed to expect the relationship is. So I like the way they do that. It adds a lot to the way that you can look at a movie like this by looking at the connection between the various characters. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I like that. Like you said, I mean, we're going to see it over the next few days, their connection, and also some of the connections that Garber has with some of the other characters around also, it fits in. So we ended it yesterday with Garber having a conference call or a 1974 type conference call with both Rico and with Daniels, and he's giving them the instructions on what Blue has said, he wants to make sure that there are no cops around, he wants them to turn the power on, he wants them to have green lights all the way down to Southbury. And as I ended yesterday by saying that Garber succinctly just tells all the demands in a very quick way. And this minute begins with him saying, "And no cops anywhere in sight." And then he responds. He asks Daniels. He goes, "Okay, sir. So we go along with that. We have to. We have no choice. But then what? What do you think they got in mind?" And Rico then responds to in this conference call and goes, "Beats the hell out of me, Z. I wouldn't have picked a tunnel to make my getaway from the first place." And then Garber responds and says, "But they did pick it. And since so far everything they've done has been worked out to the smallest detail, it stands to reason they got the rest of this worked out too." So I like the way that this conversation is going, because it's telling us, it's showing us various sides of this particular debate, I guess you can say. But they all realize that there's no room to move. Mm-hmm.
Well, what I liked about it is for Garver, he seems to be a little further along in trying to troubleshoot, because everybody else is like, well, I wouldn't have done that. I don't know why they're there. What's their plan? And he's like, well, they've worked everything else out. They must have something else. I like seeing his wheels turning as well, trying to stay, well, how are they planning their escape? I like seeing Walter Matthau. I'm telling you, and I said this earlier, impressed me, because I was always used to see him in sort of a comedic, almost a schlub role, not necessarily like in this kind of a role. For me, this was neat to see him playing, even though he's got the dial or the dialect of somebody from New York. He's thinking the whole time, and he realizes these people are not just your basic criminals. He's realized at this point they've got more up their sleeve.
I think that also when you look at movies from the 70s, in some ways, I think this is unique. Nowadays, every type of heist movie, and there's always some sort of, there's some plot twist along the way that you're not expecting and stuff like that. And usually it catches everyone by surprise. Back then, that's the way it is. Nowadays, everyone's looking for it. You watch a Tarantino movie, you watch a M. Night Shyamalan movie, you know there's some sort of plot twist, and it's just a question of trying to figure out what that plot twist is, and which is both good and bad, because it leaves too much hype. So the question is, are is it going to be satisfying enough, the twist that they have, or not?
Right. And I feel like modern filmmaking, well, at least I've seen, especially maybe more in the modern horror genre, ironically, just having finished last month Halloween, and like for us, October is always the month to watch. It's like the twist now for the sake of a twist, when you don't even need one, but they want to put one just to go, oh, look how edgy. You didn't see that coming. I'm like, yeah, but nothing in the movie supported that twist.
That's
I want a twist that is supported by the narrative, not one you just put in there for the fun of it.
correct. And so I like the fact that Garber here is a character who sees that there's something, but he just can't put a finger on it yet.
Right. And he's bringing
But he's looking for it.
Everybody into his suspicions, because he's like, I need more people than just me thinking about it. But he's articulating it out loud for all of them to see what they have to say. And it feels very collaborative. At the same time, it's like the police feel powerless because they're at the mercy of this guy who's got all these hostages. The mayor has obviously said, we're going to give in because I don't want to have this political capital hit me in the wrong time with all of my polling. It feels cool that you've got one character who's trying to work it out. He's literally in on the screen. He's trying to puzzle it out at the same time we are. Because ironically, first time I saw it, I'm like, yeah, how are they planning to get out of here? Like, I was asking myself the same thing. Like, why would you, of all things to hijack, you're trapped in a tunnel. How are you getting out of here?
Well, again, that's the question that they keep asking throughout the entire movie. We have a lot of people asking this question, and there is no easy answer in sight, which is why the twist here works, because the whole time and the characters giving other options also throws us off, trying to try and figure out what it is that's going on. I mean, obviously, once you've seen this movie, you know how everything fits in. Obviously, I know you've only seen this movie once in its entirety, so but on rewatches, so then you can plot how everything really fits in and makes sense within the idea of, okay, this is their plan. But as you're trying to figure out the plan, it's like, okay, what's going on here? What's behind all this? And the building blocks that they use here are great. Rico responds and goes, all right, power's restored and track cleared. And he goes, but why South Ferry? And he goes, well, Garber responds and goes, well, you think it's the water, Rico? He goes, maybe they got a boat in the harbor, or a seaplane or something. And he goes, I don't know. Now, what's interesting here is, he mentions a seaplane. So you'd think that if they get to the harbor, if it, I mean, for me, it's strange that this is where their thinking is taking them, because, once the train, they know that the hijackers know that the train is going to be tracked regardless. So even if they were to get to South Ferry and they get off the train and they get into a boat or a seaplane or something like that, someone's still tracking them. Even in 1974, it's not today where for sure, all the satellite footage they're going to have and everything like that, trying to figure out exactly what's going on. But back in 1974, they still had their ways of surveilling what's going on, which is, again, why the whole plot here, and for anyone who hasn't seen this movie and is listening to this, stop right now, watch the whole movie, and then come back and continue listening, because I'm about to spoil something else. But the idea is that they need to make sure that they're not on the train, but everyone thinks they're still on the train. You know,
what I'd like about this, though, is you have this in real life, and I've seen this happen whenever you're troubleshooting any problem. People will just throw out the first thing that pops in their head, and then you start talking it through, and you go, okay, well, that won't work. It makes sense, though. You're going to the South Ferry. Well, it's by the water. You know that's where you catch the ferry to go to Jersey. Could there be something in the harbor? Could there be a boat? Could there be a... They're just throwing stuff out there. It doesn't make a lot of sense when you scrutinize it, but I like the fact that it's like people are contributing the first thing that pops in their heads, which happens a lot. Right,
correct. No, I agree with you. You know, sometimes people give solutions that you really don't want to hear because they're just completely out there and they're stupid.
Because some of us go, wait a minute, have you thought that through? Because that doesn't make any sense. But sometimes people feel like, oh, I want to volunteer. That's the first thing that pops into my head. And think about it. You're heading to the harbor. You're heading to the ferry, you know, the gap between New York City and New Jersey. And yeah, that's the same ferry we came in on. We actually parked in Jersey when we visited New York City the last time we were there. We took the ferry from Jersey up to the South Ferry entrance. So I know exactly where they're talking about, but the same problem exists. You could say that, but the subway doesn't end outside next to the docks. It's still underground. You still got to come up through the subway. You still got to come up to the street level, and then you still got to walk to the ferry, right? So it's not like when you start thinking about it, like, well, that doesn't make any sense because we could just stop them getting off the subway right at the South Ferry entrance or exit, however you want to look at it. But I get it in terms of the dialogue. They're like, well, maybe they got a boat. Maybe we better think about that. Now, maybe Mr. Blue is thinking that that's what they would think and divert resources to go all of a sudden start searching the river, which of course would spread the police thin.
I, as you said, they're troubleshooting. So just throwing out ideas. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it, in theory, it's a great idea. In practice, it's not.
Correct.
Because, you know, you have to, by thinking of these type of options, you have to still also think about, okay, why would it work for them to do that? Mm-hmm. You know, what could be their plan? Obviously, there's no way for anyone to guess what their plan is because they all know about the dead man switch, which they're not aware of the fact that, you know, that they've found a way around it, you know, that type of thing. So he mentioned seaplanes. Okay. Do you know anything about the history of seaplanes? Like, when did someone make the first seaplane?
Well, I do remember in Raiders of the Lost Ark, they took off from the water on a seaplane, and that was the late 30s, so I gotta imagine it was somewhere before then.
Okay, that's a start. So you're saying it happened sometime before 1930? When did it happen?
Raiders 38? So it's gotta be Raiders? Before 38.
Raiders 38, right. Exactly. Okay, any guess how far before 1938?
Let's see. When would people... Okay, wait. No, I have no idea. I'm going to say in the late 20s, late 1920s.
It actually goes back even further than that. It was in the early 1910s.
Oh, really?
Yes. And the truth is that when people were starting to try and figure out how planes work, they attempted many times to have it start from water as opposed to, you know, wheels on the ground, thinking that that might work better. But, you know, the Wright brothers started with it on the ground. So that started. But there were two pioneers named Henry Fabre and Glenn Curtis who were able to develop the first practical aircraft that could take off and land on water. Hmm. And, you know, this was obviously right before World War One. And then in World War One, they started, you know, using it a lot more for reconnaissance, for rescue, search and rescue and things like that. Obviously, during World War Two, that expanded even more, you know, by using that because this is even before they had helicopters. Mm-hmm. So or they had just the first prototypes, I guess, of helicopters back during World War Two. But still, so the idea is that there's two different types of boats that are boat planes or seaplanes or whatever you want to call them, and they both work slightly differently. There's what's known as a float plane. Is basically, you know, it's what we usually think of. It's a plane that has two floats on it that are mounted under the fuselage, and you know, some there are planes that only have one, but I don't know how they. Then they have skids if they only have one thing there, and the idea is that it helps to balance things as it is able to try to gain speed in order to take off from that thing. Mostly those are float planes. They're usually regular planes that have, you know, these skids or floats that go under them and stuff like that. The other kind of plane that they have that works as a seaplane is known as a flying boat. Okay, and it basically the idea is this is a plane that can land in water itself and doesn't need to have a like skids underneath. And the propellers are on top and things like that. It's the fuselage itself is something that's buoyant and can stay in the water, you know, float while it's in the water. Basically, they started using those during World War One also, and then they ended up, eventually making commercial airlines out of these type of planes. So I guess in Airport 77, they didn't use that type of plane
No.
in order to keep it afloat.
No, it kind of went underwater.
Yeah. And the idea was is that it would make it was cheaper to land and take off in water than it was to have to use regular runways. I you know what? If I remember correctly, I knew you brought up Indiana Jones before, but I'm pretty sure in Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade, he's on a boat that we see is he's on a plane that lands in the water. That lets him off when he gets to, you know, when he shows up in
In
Vienna.
Venice.
Venice, sorry, Venice. I got the V right, you
You
know.
did. I don't know how
Venice.
much water there you would land in Vienna, but you could land in a mountain.
Probably not. Probably not. Probably not. Yeah, so Vienna, I apologize. Thank you for correcting me on
All right. It's all right.
that. Exactly.
Is interesting to
And
think, and
then,
you have to
Dan.
wonder, maybe from a safety perspective, they're like, well, it's. If you're going to have an emergency landing, landing in water feels safer than trying to have an emergency landing on land.
Just ask Sully,
Yeah.
right? Exactly. And then Daniels gets back into the conversation and he goes, I don't know. We better play it one step at a time. Lieutenant Garber, you see about restoring that power and clearing the tracks, and I'll start pulling our units out of the tunnel. We can follow them just as well on the street. Except how do we know where they'll be? So first of all, his comment here is a little strange because you know, he says you see about restoring the power, but didn't Rico just say in this conference call that they've restored the power?
Well, I
So
think
maybe he has a little bit of a lag in his connection.
well that or you know they're just basically recapping everything anyway. You know, they said we needed to restore the power, and even though he said he goes, we're working on that or we got that, you know, he's like, well, you guys keep doing that, as if it takes longer than just turning the switch on, but okay, whatever.
Right, maybe. Possible. And he says, let's play things one step at a time. Have you do you know anything about where, first of all, what the phrase one step at a time means or where it comes from?
Ooh. One step at a time. Well, okay. I've never thought about this, but now you're making me think about it on the fly. But I do
Isn't that
know
what I always do?
you do, and I can honestly tell you once again, would have never thought that that was going to be part of the conversation from today's minute.
I'm glad to once again surprise
You
you.
always are. You are very surprising, sir. Well, I know there's always that proverb. Crap, where does it come from? But basically, like the journey. Oh, how's it called? The journey of a thousand steps begin with like the journey of a thousand miles begins with the first step or something like that. Have you heard that?
Okay. Yes, it is connected to that.
That's the only time I think about it in that terminology, one step at a time.
It's, the actual proverb is a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step.
Okay. So I was close. I had the overall general meaning.
You of course. You're definitely in the right ballpark with that.
But that's about all when you put one step in front of the other, it just feels like, well, that's like the other thing that popped in my head, which is kind of silly, is The Sound of Music, which is like, when you read, you begin with ABC. When you sing, you begin with Do, Re, Mi. You got to do one before you can do the other.
That's right. That's a very good connection. I don't think that's what Daniels was referring to, but it is possible. Maybe he is a fan of Julie Andrews. It is possible.
I'm sure not. But you asked me personally, where have I heard that from? And those are the first two things that popped into my head. That's it. But I have never really... I have not put a lot of deep thought into where the etymology of the phrase one step in front of the other.
Okay. So it, as you alluded to it, it originated from the proverb by Lao Tzu.
I didn't even say it.
Which is a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. And the idea is, in order to solve something, to finish something, you have to start I'm trying not to use the phrase one step at a time. You have to do one portion of it, in order to move along and do the whole thing. There are other idioms that are similar to it. You have one day at a time, one thing at a time, and slow and steady wins the race. The phrase basically means to do something slowly and carefully in stages rather than all at once. And what it does is it encourages a deliberate pace in order to avoid feeling overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. Don't jump to the end. Start now. Do what you can, and then you'll eventually get to where you need to. You'll come to some sort of solution.
This is what
they're trying to do.
This is exactly how I phrased it to my girls when they would let their rooms get too messy, and then they'd have that sense of being overwhelmed. I'm like, look, start with just one thing. Just make your bed. Once you've got a clean bed, now you can take the stuff off your dresser, put it on top of the bed to clean your dresser, and then you've got, but one thing at a time. So yeah, same thing, same premise. Don't try to do it all at once. Do it one little piece at a time.
Yep, exactly. It makes sense. So Daniels gives some good advice. But then he ends his question comments with a question: how do we know where they'll be? And then the response that he gets is, Grand Central Tower has them on their model board, sir. We can see every move they make. They stop any place before South Ferry, we'll know that. Obviously we know about this because we've seen the model board throughout the entire movie. Showing, the little lights, the 1974 lights lighting up, mm-hmm. telling us where something is moving. Every time I think about that, I always say to myself, if they would have made this movie in 2025, the amount of technology they would have used in order to, they would probably use AI technology or VR technology to try and show where the train is and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's nice to see the technology from that time that still makes sense in the way that they do it.
Well, can I tell you another thing
without having to overdo
it? We talked about it yesterday, I think, about the way the facility looked, and it had that 70s just feel. This everything just feels like you've taken a step back in time. I was actually impressed by the fact that they had rudimentary electronic I don't even want to call it computer, but they were able to kind of track where the trains are with these lights on a board back in 1974. Like, for some reason I was thinking, how did they track where the trains were? It was kind of cool to see that, because I've never been in one of these, control centers. I had no idea what it looked like back then. But the idea of having this kind of a command center with an LED, well, it's not even LED, just regular light bulbs tracking where those trains are, was actually kind of neat.
That's one of the things I love about watching movies from other, from the past.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see how, does it work? Like even if you were to look at a movie like Star Wars and you say, oh, wow, the effects that they used in 1977 are archaic as of now. But when you look at it within the framework of when the movie came out, you can say, oh, wow, yeah. This was so innovative at the time, even though today it doesn't look innovative.
Right.
You know, that type
And
of
I
thing.
do like that snapshot where you do, and this is the thing that I always argue with people, you know, when you watch a movie that's older, you have to put your mind in this, in, you have to put your viewing lens into the mindset of that era. And it's nice because when you have something that was set as a modern thriller for the 74 audience, it was set in that time. So now if you've never lived in that time, you get a sense of what the dress looks like, what the commute was like, what the stations look like, and the technology, and how far we've come. It's really kind of cool to be able to do that, to kind of go backwards and then see how far we've advanced.
Yeah. Again, going back to the Star Wars analogy, that was one of the difficult things when they made the Star Wars prequels, that they had to, you know, they had better technology that we can show, but you need to still make it seem as if it's technology that came before the technology that was used 22 years earlier.
Right.
You know, that type of thing. Daniel says, "Well, I'll check back in when I get to my car." And then Rico, you know, we see him. It looks like he has a light bulb go over his head, and he goes, "Hey, wait a minute! I think I just figured out how they're gonna get away." Garber responds and says, "I'm listening." He goes, "They're gonna fly the train to Cuba." Then Garber responds to end this minute by saying, "You're a sick man, Rico."
You know what I like about that line, especially for the 70s audience with, you know, Cuban refugees at, on the post-Cuban Missile Crisis turning, you know, communist and the Cold War era. What Rico's saying is the idea of trying to sneak out of a subway tunnel is every bit as stupid as if trying to think that it's going to sprout wings and fly to Cuba. Like he's literally saying how it's impossible for them to get away.
That's very true. Now, the idea though that about hijackings to Cuba, the reason that he's mentioning it is because there were so many planes that were hijacked in the late 60s, early 70s, where they were going to Cuba. Okay, there were 159 aircraft hijackings by Castro's rebels, and 85 of them were taken towards Cuba.
Interesting.
Okay, I actually found a list of all of them. I'm not even going to go anywhere near that to try and figure out how many of them there were. The funny thing is, in 1974 there was only one, because they made an agreement in 1973 to stop them. So in 1974 the only one that was on December 14th, and it's about someone named Robert Harrison, Robin Harrison, chartered a plane by phone. When he arrived at the airport in Tampa, he points a gun at the pilot and demands that he flies to Cuba. You know, that's the only story of something from 1974 with Cuba. And the next one was 4 years later, in 1978, when someone hijacked a plane in San Francisco, a United flight in San Francisco, and he claimed to have high explosives with a pipe bomb and wanted to go to Cuba. The plane ended up landing in Oakland, and they let the crew and passengers disembark because they wanted to refuel in order to get to Cuba. And then police cars surrounded the plane. The hijacker panicked and forced the crew to take off. Then the flight had to land in Denver because they didn't have enough fuel. And while they were in Denver, and they were waiting for the fuel truck to show up, the crew escaped by jumping out the open cockpit windows. And the guy ended up surrendering to the FBI because he couldn't fly the plane and didn't have any more hostages.
Oops. He was not Mr. Blue.
No.
He had not thought wisely. He had not planned
No,
wisely.
he did not. No. And all three of the flight crew who jumped out of the plane, all three of them were injured, but they recovered from their injuries and were all able to return back to flight duty within a few months. So,
Nice.
you know, because you'd think jumping out of a plane, you know, even if it's stationary, is not going to be so simple. But yeah, so I mean, that's the basic gist of it. That at the time when this movie came out, or when they were making the movie, everyone was, or everyone, I mean, there were a lot of people that were hijacking planes to Cuba. So it sort of makes sense. I guess people watching this at the time would have understood it a little better, you know, or would have understood the joke a little better. I mean, again, you're right. It it's very funny. It's a funny line, especially, you know, when they're talking about the South Ferry and seaplanes and stuff like that. So let's just, you know, we now have a transforming subway car that can fly.
Right.
You know, that. So yeah, that I like the way that they do that. Okay, so did you have anything else you wanted to mention about this particular minute?
No, I think we kind of covered it.
All right. So every Wednesday we have a segment called Hijack Hump Day, where my guests will give their top five movies that feature some sort of hijacking. Once again, why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
All right. Well, again, I find myself doing something that is related to the film we're actually breaking down. My number five is now this film, The Taking of Pelham 123.
Ooh. Yeah. You see, I'm so glad that you've enjoyed this movie enough that you keep adding it to your list. That's great.
It's been nice because every one of these days so far this week, it's in the top five, whether it was a Walter Matthau performance, a Robert Shaw performance, or now a Hijack movie, it's in my top five. Number four, and it's a little bit of a sillier movie, but I kind of liked it. I liked it because I love Kurt Russell. I also liked it because I thought Steven Seagal was going to do a lot bigger role in it, and he ends up being, you know, one of those guys that you know the name and he gets whacked early. But I liked Executive Decision. I thought that was a really good hijack movie, and trying to figure out how you're going to do a hijacking on an airline. So I like Executive Decision number four.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that is a great choice.
Number three, and I'll have words with anybody if they don't think it's a hijack movie. But I think it is one of, and it still holds up to this day, as one of my favorite sort of techno thrillers, The Hunt for Red October. I think the idea of a Russian, a high-level official in the Russian Navy deciding to hijack a submarine designed to start World War III and try to get back to the Americans and try to figure out how to not get blown up in the process, I still love that movie.
Okay, well, I got to say you were the very first person this entire season to use that movie.
Really?
On this list. Yes.
But would you argue with me?
I wouldn't argue with you at all. I agree. I think it is an hijack movie, but I never would have thought of it until you mentioned it.
Okay. Well, there we go.
Now
we
have you've enlightened me also. You've enlightened me also. There you go.
Something new to think about. Number two should be very familiar to you and your audience from your Die Hard days. Die Hard 2 as a hijack movie. They hijacked the airport, but they also tried to hijack a plane to get out of there. So I'm picking Die Hard 2 as a hijack movie.
Okay. I would agree with that also.
But my number one, and maybe I got to think for airplanes, my number one all-time favorite hijack movie, and it still holds up. I watched it maybe 5 months ago, Air Force One.
I knew you were going there.
It is so good. And they came up with ways to create tension and believability. The fight scene. I mean, Air Force One is just a great movie. It is a great, fun film. You know, Gary Oldman is a great bad guy. Harrison Ford as the president, and it's gritty and it's shocking when they literally will assassinate. I mean, it's good. It's one of my favorites.
Yeah, I completely can agree with that one. So every day we have a daily segment called Name That Remake, where my guests will have to guess what movie I'm talking about just by some little clues that we're going to have to try to figure out you know, what movie has been remade and whether it's a good movie or not. Okay. You know,
I'm ready.
All right, so let's spin the wheel and see where can we.
I'm two for two this week, so I'm going for lucky number three. I'm going for Turkey.
All right. Let's see what you get.
Okay. I'm always nervous with you.
Okay. This is a movie you probably don't even know was remade, but we'll see with that. So the original movie came out in 1946, and the remake came out in 1977. Okay. And it's about a person who gets to see what the world would be like if they never existed.
Oh. Well, there's a lot of those.
And I know that you've seen the original movie. I can guarantee that you've seen the original
movie. Yeah, because it was part of your series.
Yes, it was.
It So it, but I didn't know they remade it.
Did
they
yes,
really
they did.
Remake It's a Wonderful Life?
They remade It's a Wonderful Life in 1977, and they switched it. They made it that the main character is a woman.
I don't have any knowledge. I have no memory of this place. I had no idea they remade it.
It's called It Happened One Christmas. It was with Marlo Thomas. He played the main character.
Well, oh, all right then.
it was an okay remake. I mean, again, I've seen the original so many times. So I just like the way that they change things around a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously the bad guy there was Orson Welles. He played Harry Potter, Henry Potter.
Harry Potter, huh?
Well, his Potter's name is Harry Potter. His full name is Harry F. Potter, but he's known as Henry Potter. Harry and Henry are interchangeable. And she has a female angel that helps her named Clara, played by Cloris Leachman. But my favorite character in that movie is, well, actually, you know what? Now that I'm looking at the list, there are actually three people. Well, there's two people that are in this movie, Taking Pelham 1-2-3, that were in that movie.
Really?
Yes. But first of all, I'm going to say I'll talk about those two first. So first, Dick O'Neill, the guy who we're going to see a lot of this week, Frank, he plays Mr. Gower, you know, the druggist. And Doris Roberts plays Ma Bailey.
So you know Doris Roberts from a lot of TV shows, but probably everyone loves Raymond the best.
Yeah, of course. But I mean, I don't know if you noticed this. She was the mayor's wife in this movie.
Oh my God, really? I did not.
Yes.
I did not
recognize
her.
The mayor's wife. Well, it is probably about 30 years before she was on Everybody Loves Raymond. Or,
yeah.
No, probably 25 years.
Wow.
I'm trying to remember what year Everybody Loves Raymond came out. But yeah. No, but my favorite casting in that movie, It Happened One Christmas, is Barney Martin as Uncle Willie. Barney Martin is Jerry Seinfeld's father on Seinfeld.
Mm.
And he plays, you know, the uncle, you know, Uncle Billy. So here he's Uncle Willie.
Mm.
Yeah, again, it's fun watching, but it's not a great. If you're going to watch either that or the original, go back and watch the original.
Yeah, yeah, I would think so.
That's what I would say. Yeah. So, Alan, would you like to tell people where they can find Alan Sanders?
Sure, super easy. I guess everybody's their own brand today, and since I've got a news talk show, you can find The Alan Sanders Show wherever you find podcasts. And then depending where your social media hangouts, you can just do a Google search or do a search in those different things, whether it's Facebook, X, Instagram, Gather Truth Social, YouTube. Just look for The Alan Sanders Show.
All right. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook, find me on Twitter, find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, moviearoundminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to moviearoundminute@movierob.net. So until tomorrow,
achoo. Gesundheit.